So my name is Seth, and I'm going to be giving my talk on basically on Turing machines and finite automata and all of those wonderful things that you learn in theoretical computer science. Does anybody here know what a Turing machine is? Just to start. All right, we've got a few hands. That's a good sign. Well, we know who you are, so.
About time.
Okay, well, I guess let me start off with a simpler question. Does anybody here program? Anybody? Okay. Does anybody here program in, say, a language like Perl? Anybody? Okay, we've got a few people. Do people here know what regular expressions are? Yes? Okay. I guess we're off to a good start then. I'm going to start by talking about regular expressions. If I say something that you guys don't understand, or if you can't see something up on the board, because it's a pretty small board, feel free to raise your hand or yell at me or get my attention somehow, and I'll stop and let you know what's going on. No. So I'm going to start by talking about regular expressions. Can anybody here who's worked with regular expressions tell me what goes into a regular expression? Anybody? Come on, audience participation. We need some.
It's a string that describes a set of strings.
Okay. When you're writing a regular expression, what sort of things can you do with it? Like, for example, you can use the star to match any number of things. Okay. Anybody else? Regular expressions. Any input on what they are, what they do, how well you guys understand them? I see how this is going to go. All right, well, regular expressions, basically, they do pattern matching in this sense. You can, if you're using a program, has anybody here ever used grep? Yeah, okay. So we all know what grep is and how grep works, and basically you use it to find a substring in a larger string, and you can do all sorts of funky pattern matching through these regular expressions. Well, for the everybody's understanding, a regular expression can be defined in three steps. It's defined recursively in this case. So you have your base case where nothing. What? Are you giving me other markers?
They're magnums.
Oh no, they are magnums.
I don't care anything else. Is that what we
heard?
Overcompensation. So, regular expressions, you can start off with nothing. Nothing, that is a valid regular expression. You can have, for the other base cases, any sort of symbol. If you have an alphabet, let's say the alphabet is sigma, any character in the alphabet by itself is a valid regular expression. So in this case, if you have your alphabet equal to A, B, and C, either A, B, or C is a valid regular expression. There's also the idea of a null character, or lambda. That's also a valid regular expression. So nothing, the null, or any one character from the alphabet is considered the starting point for a valid regular expression. Then there's the recursive step. There are three ways that you can extend a regular expression. The first way you can extend it is through union. So if you have, this marker sucks. You can take the union of two things. So in this case, if you have A and B as regular expressions, you can take the union of them, which basically means or. So you can have A or you can have B. You can do concatenation. So if A and B are regular expressions, AB is a regular expression. And you can use the Clini star, which does multiple matches of the same regular expression. So if A is, A star is as well, which means it'll match zero or more occurrences of the regular expression A. There's a third rule in here, a rule of closure. Basically, it's only a regular expression if you use these properties a finite number of times. You can't use it forever. So as long as there's only a finite number of times that you use this, it's still a regular expression, and this is all that defines it. Any of the fancier patterns that you can use in, say, Perl or regexp in general on a Unix system, for example, are not necessary to actually define regular expressions. Like, for example, plus is defined somewhere, where plus means you match one or more instances of the regular expression A, and this is really just equivalent to that. So you can take any of the other patterns that you can match for using a regular expression and break it down to these basic rules. So, any questions so far? Yes?
Can we move the thing forward or maybe the podium back?
Sure. How about that?
Thank you.
It's like magnificent. All right, so. Is this going to work? All right. So. You're probably wondering at this point, what the hell does this have to do with anything? I talked about programming without coding and computers without hardware. Well, regular expressions do pattern matching. You can use,
Are the other point going to be bringing up quantum states, DNA machines, or,
Quantum states what machines?
No, are you going to be discussing quantum states of computing?
Oh, no, I'm not going to get into quantum computing. This man does not speak on my behalf, but you can still leave right now. Just so that we're clear. I'm not going to be talking about quantum machines, but I am going to be getting into finite automata, because anything that you can match with a regular expression, you can create a machine to match as well. And you're probably wondering what you mean by a machine, or what I mean by a machine. I can talk, really. So, let me check my notes to see where I'm going to go with this. I'm going to bring up the concept of a context-free grammar at this point. Has anybody here worked with grammars at all? Yes, okay. It's a pretty good audience. Basically...
Wait,
it's not a shot. I filled my mouth and then took
it. Shoot what's left.
All right.
Peer pressure. Yeah! Talking that.
All right. A grammar... A grammar is a way of defining a language. Languages can be seen as a thing that are matched, in this case, by an expression or a regular expression. The set of all strings that is matched by the expression can be seen as the language. So, a context-free grammar is made up of four parts. Notes. Where is that noise coming from? All right, four parts. V is a set of variables. Sigma is the alphabet that I mentioned before, the characters that you'd be matching over. P are a set of rules or productions. And S is a special symbol in V that is considered to be the starting point of all pattern matching. Now, what this does is rules work, or the rules go from a variable name to what this means is variables go to either variables or characters to be matched over and any number of them. So the union, this here is a regular expression. We have the union here, which means one or the other, and the star, which means as many or no of them, none of them, as you want. So, you know, as an example, you could have, if we use capital letters as the rule names and lowercase letters as the actual symbols, a grammar might be along the lines of So, can everybody see this?
Yeah, sure.
All right. So what this means is that if you have a character A and a rule A and a character B, then you would substitute for the rule A, the character A and the rule B. The rule B in this case, you would either substitute the rule B with the symbol B, the symbol C, or nothing. And using these steps, you can build up an entire language of strings that you could then use the grammar to efficiently match over. And grammars are very related to expressions. And so this is a grammar. Don't be too concerned by this if you don't fully understand it. Going to get into regular grammars, though. Regular grammars are a special set of grammars that will correspond to regular expressions. They take a very simple form in that if you have a rule, any rule A, it can either go to a single variable, it can go to a variable and another rule, or it can go to nothing. Remember, lambda is the do-nothing case, so in this case, if you have it, you can just take it out, substitute it for nothing, and you're done. So any grammar that only has rules of this type is a regular grammar, and it corresponds to a regular expression. So this is just another way of representing these regexps that everybody uses on a fairly regular basis. No pun intended. So where I'm really going with this is what's so interesting about regular expressions anyway, and this is where the computers without hardware part comes in. You can make these finite state machines, basically a collection of states and transitions. Has anybody here worked with state machines? No? Yes? All right. We've got you. We've got one other guy.
DOT.
Right. Okay. So.
Yeah, state machines.
Right.
What? Have a couple more shots, man.
This is an example of one of these finite state machines. Over here, this weird symbol here means that's where you start. Like the little arrow is like going into the starting. And are you wasting the tequila?
No, no. He's just hitting her with a bottle.
Oh, okay. You start off in this state with a little arrow going in. And then if you see an A, that means you can transition into this state over here. This state has two transitions. If you see another A, you can transition down here. If you see a B, you just loop back into the same state. The two circles over here means that if you end in that state, it's considered to be valid, and you're done, and everything is all good. If you notice, there's no B transition over here, or C transition, or Q transition, or anything like that. If there's no transition for a character that's allowed in your alphabet and you get it when you're in a certain state, that means you're done. And you stop where you are, and as long as it's not one of these final states, then it's not accepted, and whatever string you're reading in isn't part of the language. It's not accepted by your regular expression. So here's a very simple machine. Can anybody tell me what regular expression this corresponds to? Yes. Okay. Yeah. Does everybody see how that works? There's an A that's required here. There's a B here that you can do as many times as you want, but it's not required because you can just do another A over here. So this whole machine is A, B star, A. No, because that's not built into the regular expressions. Yeah, if you're doing a new line, then you're assuming, like if you're doing start of line and end of line characters or whatever, you're assuming that those are part of your alphabet. I guess I can make this a little more defined as saying the alphabet is A and B.
Well, it's not just new lines, it's whether you implicitly match to
just start and end of a line.
Yeah.
But that's not an official part of regular expressions. because the new line and end of line can be seen as special characters that aren't necessarily part of your alphabet.
Yeah.
So it's not absolutely necessary, but if you're doing a Perl regex, then yeah. So people understand the correspondence between these machines and regular expressions? I see a whole lot of... Yeah, if anybody wants to do a field trip into the other room, she's coordinating.
Find your buddy.
So this sort of machine is called a deterministic finite automata, or automaton, because there's only one of them. It's deterministic because for each state, you can only transition one way for each character. It's finite because you're only allowed to have a finite number of states, and it's a machine, so that's why it's an automaton. These DFAs correspond to regular expressions. If you have a regular expression, then you can build one of these machines that will do the same thing as your regular expression. It will do a search for a substring in a larger string, which is the input to the machine, and it will tell you whether it's there or not. Everybody following? Any questions so far? Yes?
I have a dumb question.
Yeah.
Stupid question. What's the general purpose for a state machine?
The general purpose?
Yeah.
If you're doing it in terms of theory, then it's a nice way to look at things. If you're doing like electrical engineering or something like that, then you can actually build these machines. But in this case, it's just a nice way of being able to diagram the internals of pattern matching, and then if you wanted to actually implement a machine, you could build it. Don't know why you would want to, but you could build it in software. And building these state machines in software is one way of doing the pattern matching that is very, very efficient, because this is what you're doing. So,
okay. Thanks.
No problem. So there are three types of these finite state machines that will take regular expressions, and the more advanced ones can all be reduced down to one of this type. This is a DFA because it's deterministic. You can also have non-deterministic machines like this. And that basically means that if you have a state here, you can have a transition from one symbol here and another transition from the same symbol somewhere else. And when you get to that point, if you have that transition, you will split out and go down every single branch at once. That's the non-determinism in action. And as long as one path ends up in a final accepting state, then it doesn't matter where all the other paths went. One way of looking at a non-deterministic algorithm is if you're going through a maze. Does anybody know like the basic algorithm for finding the solution to going through a maze? Anybody? Okay. You guys know what's going on. So forget you guys. Sorry. If you're going through a maze, you can take the general approach of every time I come to a fork, I'll turn left. And then if you hit a wall, then you just backtrack, go back, and take your next left. And eventually, this will get you out of the maze. It might take a really long time. You might have to do a whole lot of backtracking. But you'll eventually get out of the maze. A non-deterministic algorithm says every time you come to a fork in the maze, go down every single path at once. And every time you come to another fork, go every single path at once. And then as soon as one copy of you finds the way out of the maze, then forget about the rest of you because you're out of the maze. And it can be shown that these non-deterministic algorithms these machines can be reduced to deterministic ones in this case. So it's a lot more convenient. Yes?
So you could say every non-deterministic algorithm could be broken down into two or more deterministic algorithms?
In this case, if you have a non-deterministic machine, when you go down each path at once, if you want to turn this into a deterministic machine, what you can do is you can take the fact that you're in this state and this state at the same time and turn them into one new state in a deterministic machine. And then if you're in this state and this state or this state and this state, every single combination of states that you can get into, you can turn into a single state in a deterministic machine. So you'll get a whole lot more states, like a ridiculous lot more states, depending on whatever machine you have. But you can, if you want to be able to turn it into a deterministic machine, you can do it that way. So they're equivalent. There's one other type of machine more one other special feature of these machines that you can do that makes things more convenient but doesn't necessarily add any more power in case it really doesn't, is that you can have these lambda transitions. And remember, lambda is the whole null character, which means if you get over here, then you can just jump to that state without doing anything. And you might wonder, you know, why is doing nothing and jumping useful? But, all right, going back to regular expressions. Remember the first way of doing a regular expression is you have this union, which means A or B. Well, in this case, if you're, this is the start of your regular expression. And you have these lambda transitions. So what you can do is if you start off here, you can lambda transition either way, and then you can do A or you can do B. Thank you, Fizz. And in this case, it's not just one state that can go out by A or can go out by B, because in this case, A and B aren't just symbols. They can be any other regular expression. So A could be really C, D star, D, 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 D union, F, F star. And it would all fit into one of these. And you could go either way, and you could do the first part, or you could do the second part, and either way you end up at the same place. So these lambda transitions are pretty useful, and you'll also see that this is non-deterministic. So where the deterministic machines were DFAs, the non-deterministic machines are NFAs. This is an NFA lambda because it's non-deterministic and it has these lambda transitions. So these NFA lambdas do the same thing as regular expressions for pattern matching. And you can build these machines fairly simply from regular expressions, and then you can implement them to do pattern matching. You can build them in hardware. You can do whatever you want with them if you're so inclined. So this is what I'm getting at with, you know, programming without coding. Right, what you're doing right here is implementing by drawing circles and lines. You're implementing a regular expression pattern matching engine. And it is the pattern matching engine because it will take any regular expression no matter how complicated. And I was really hoping to have some code done by now that would take a regular expression and use GraphViz to actually show the circles and the lines and plot it, but it's not done, so sorry.
Even though you worked for the wee hours of last night.
Shut up. Shut up.
Yeah. That's what you get for not coding. Drink.
So is everybody with me so far? How much time do I have left? Half an hour. Okay. So if we have the regular expression A star, how would we represent it using one of these machines? Simple one. Come on. Somebody from this side. All right, you. You made eye contact first. How would you do that? Yeah. Come on.
It can't be done, apparently.
Can't be done? All right.
Just have a loop on itself.
So one state and that? Yeah.
Thank you.
That's absolutely correct. With one exception, and that's you have to have some sort of other thing going out. Or if it's at the end of an expression, you have to make it be the final state. Because you need some way of having it end or continue on.
Why?
Why? I'm not answering that because you're you. Shut up, Earl. All right. So, who here has heard of a Turing machine again? Anybody other than like this guy and this guy? All right. We've got a few people. There are a whole number of different classes of expressions, languages, grammars. They're all equivalent, that can be accepted by different kinds of machines like this. And in some case, in most cases, these other machines are more powerful than these DFAs, NFAs, and NFA lambdas. So what we have is that DFAs correspond to regular expressions. We can then also have there are things called pushdown automata, which correspond to context-free grammars or expressions or anything. Context-free just means that when you have those rules for a grammar that I showed back here, when you have these sort of rules, you're not allowed something like this, because this means the rules in context. Because you've got an A over here and a B over there, that means the rules in context. If there are no rules in context, then it's context-free. So there are these class of machines called pushdown automata, which work similar to DFAs or NFAs, except they have a stack. And you can push things onto the stack, and you can pop things from the stack to use them later on. And this actually grants you a whole lot more power that lets you accept a whole class of new languages that regular expressions cannot touch. The next higher up class are Turing machines. And Turing machines don't necessarily stop. There's no real way of telling whether, if you have a Turing machine and you give it a certain input, whether the machine will actually stop or continue looping on forever. So if it doesn't stop, or doesn't necessarily stop, then you can accept recursively innumerable languages. And if it does stop, then recursive languages. Or do I have that backwards? I think I have that right. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, tequila. So, what are these Turing machines? Turing machines are really what I want to get at, because it kind of makes me sad that a whole lot of people who are into computers don't know what Turing machines are, let alone who Turing was.
Alan Turing.
Yes, Alan. Does everybody know who Alan Turing is?
I think we talked to him last night.
Yeah. Wow, that's impressive.
He said something about bomb.
Bomb. Yeah, not nearly enough. All right, so Turing machines are another class of these automata, but they have a few special properties added. All of the start states, the finish states, the transitions, they're all mostly the same, except when you have a transition, there are now two parts to the transition. There's a symbol you read, a symbol you write, and a symbol you move on. And you're wondering what the read and write is? Well, Turing machines have another... Yeah. I'm getting to that. Turing machines have another component. They have basically a tape. And the tape extends off infinitely in one direction.
Is it scotch tape?
Yes, scotch tape.
Duct tape.
And it's got a read-write head. And the tape will start off with stuff on it, possibly. So now you can have input to one of these machines and have output from one of them. The input is anything that is on the tape when the machine starts, and the output is anything that's written on the tape when the machine ends. So, actually, it's not this, it's... Sorry. It's the direction to move.
Yeah. I'm sorry, you have to
drink now. Yeah, I have to drink now.
Did you just grab it?
Just
cross
it in and then write it in.
Shut up. It's a different M.
It's
German.
There it is, buddy.
So.
Certainly not a cockroach.
Wrong call.
Yeah, that's next door.
Cockroach.
If you need to go next door to take out your aggressions, you're more than welcome to.
I haven't finished drinking yet.
Okay. So, what this allows you to do is have input and output. So, in addition to the regular symbols you're working with, there's one more symbol. So you have your alphabet, sigma, and you have another symbol, we'll call it capital B for blank.
Booyah.
It basically means any sort of blank space on the tape. So you can assume that anything after whatever your input is when the machine starts is blank on the tape. And there's as much tape as you need. It goes off infinitely, and you can use it all, you can use most of it. Well, you can't because it's infinite. But you can do whatever the hell you want with the tape, it really doesn't matter. What?
It's so, physical stuff.
Well, it's not necessarily physical, it's conceptual. You don't actually want to build something with an infinitely sized tape. That's kind of hard to do.
More than anything but Ethernet contest.
trying to build something with an infinitely large component is kind of difficult to do. So, if anybody has been able to do it, please let me know because I'd be
large component.
Overcompensation. So these Turing machines let you do all sorts of more complicated and neat stuff, and they'll actually let you do computation because you can encode your input, and you can encode your output, and you can actually get results from it. And you might only have A and B or 0 and 1 to work with, but as long as you come up with some method of encoding, you can put any data in and any data out. And you can put as much data in as you want and as much data out as you want. In fact, you can even encode Turing machines and send them as input or output to or from another Turing machine. So what are these Turing machines? Can anybody tell me basically what one of these is?
It's a state machine?
Well, on a more higher level.
Computer.
Yes.
That's not me, yo.
Yes. Turing machines are a generalized idea on the theoretical level of computers. They've got storage. They've got processing power. What else do you need? Anything else that you need to do can be done with one of these two things. Anybody object?
If all it has is a tape, how do you use it to look at pornography?
Because you encode the pornography as zeros and ones or whatever your alphabet is on the tape. And how do you listen to it? You've got me there. If you can give me a Turing machine that will display pornography, I will be very impressed. Very impressed. I suggest you get right on that. So Turing machines are computers. Today, I mean, you don't have an infinitely sized tape, but you have so much storage that it might as well be infinite. Hard drives are cheap, memory is cheap, and you know, you might not be able to have chimteen hojillion gigabytes of storage, but you don't really need it all. And unless you need it all, it doesn't really matter. So it might as well be infinite. Yes, hojillion, that's a technical term. Shut up. Yes, that's a technical term. One interesting thing is how the tape starts off somewhere and goes off in one direction. You can show that the type of tape really isn't important as long as it's infinite. If you have a tape that goes off in two directions, if you have five of these tapes that go off in one or two or three directions, if you have some sort of, you know, fourth dimensional tape.
What if it's a sphere?
That as long as it's infinite. If you're using spherical coordinates for your tape, that is also acceptable.
Well, what if your tape is looped back around?
Well, then it's not infinite, so you get nothing.
It's like a fax machine.
But it's been done.
Nothing. So the type of tape is unimportant as long as you have enough memory on the tape to do whatever you need to do. And these are computers. So where is I going to go from here?
Why is this important to a programmer?
Because...
You know where it started.
Well, this is important to programmers because most people who code have no idea what the hell they're doing.
Bitches!
Like, it really comes down to that. Yeah. Most people don't think out their code before they write it. Most people don't have any conceptual understanding of what makes a computer tick.
And
shut up. I'll fucking kill you. I will stab you with this magnum. All right?
Now who's compensating?
But yeah, if you have a better understanding of how these computers work and what you can do with them, you can program a lot better. You can optimize. Trying to write a very simple program on a Turing machine fucking sucks. Why? Because there's a whole lot of fucking states, there's a whole lot of transitions, there's a lot of read and write from the tape, especially if you want to do something like work with a two-dimensional tape or whatever. It's a pain in the ass. And, you know, it's a lower level than assembly language. And a lot of people...
Might want to mention BrainFuck.
Yeah, oh, BrainFuck? Who here knows about BrainFuck? Okay. How about you go for it? Because you brought it up. You can go for it.
BrainFuck is one of these languages that kind of shows the power and difficulty of a Turing machine because it's the most simple Turing-complete language you can possibly get. Its instruction base is about 6 instructions. And with those 6 instructions, you can do branching, looping, and all the other things you need to do to actually run a program. So you can write things like DCSS in BrainFuck. Somebody did.
Yeah. BrainFuck basically corresponds to things like move left in memory, move right in memory, go over here and do this, and it vaguely corresponds to a very, very low-level system like Turing machines. But these are even lower than assembly because assembly handles a lot of the internals of taking your program and actually making machine code out of it. It does it all for you. In this case, you get nothing. You have to do everything on your own. If you want it, you have to do it yourself. So having a basic understanding of how these things work, what they do, what they can do, what they can't do, and what the sort of things you're allowed to do with them to get shortcuts and to speed things up makes you a better programmer. I wouldn't say that everybody would benefit from learning about this stuff, but if you're trying to do anything other than, you know, look at me, I write in Visual C++ and, you know, Clippy tells me this and Clippy tells me that, then this is probably a very good thing to know. Because there's no fucking Clippy for Turing machines. And if somebody implements it, I'll stab you.
Can you draw a Clippy?
Okay, can I draw a Clippy?
You know your Turing machine looks like SMBs.
It's Clippy. There we go. There's Clippy. He's smiling because he's Clippy. Yeah, there's no Clippy. If somebody can implement Clippy on a Turing machine, I'll stab him. <That's all. laughs> I will fucking knife you right where you stand. That's all there is to it.
No, this is a personal letter. Sorry.
All right. Well, how much time do I have left?
Let's see. Let's go to the other talk.
143? Yeah, if you want to go to the other talk now and heckle, you're more than welcome to. Otherwise,
remember, I have pictures and proof.
I am going to teach a little interesting thing about Turing machines. So anybody who wants to stick around for that, cool. Otherwise, if you want to go and heckle the other talk, you're more than welcome to. So go.
I think you need to heckle.
No. I don't want to get kicked out of this con.
Field trip, everybody. That might be fucking awesome.
This reminds me that the Soviet Russian programmers didn't have the tools we had here, so they're tighter in their code. So
Yeah.
This was some of the more interesting. The Australians who actually destroyed the Turing machine and GCHQ, which is an ass ton. The Australians had paper tape that would loop through the machine.
They'd
run the paper tape faster and faster to try to get it to run faster and faster until the tape would actually disintegrate.
Yeah. Paper does that. All right, so you guys stuck around, so it means you want to hear something interesting about Turing machines. One problem with Turing machines is that because of all of these complicated rules that you've introduced to the system, it's hard to tell whether the machine halts or not on a given input. In fact, you can't do it unless you actually run the input and after a while give up and have it be probabilistic and say, okay, well, this has been running for 50 years. I'm guessing it's not doing anything at this point. There is no way of telling whether a Turing machine will actually stop on a given input. And I'd like to show you how this works, a proof of why this is. So if anybody is scared of proofs or scared of this sort of stuff, this is your cue to leave and go heckle Mr. Scott. All right. So.
Tech clubs are more fun, man.
Shut up.
It's the computer art scene this year.
So, say we've got a Turing machine H. We'll just call it H for halting. And we want to tell whether a given Turing machine or given computer program, depending on how you want to look at it, will actually stop or not. And the machine has two inputs. It has an encoding of another machine, in this case, whatever machine you want to check for. It might be a computer program, it might be a simple Turing machine, it can be whatever you want. And it has an input W to this machine. So you can see the representation of the machine, like M could be Microsoft Word, it could be a very simple Turing machine that I drew over here, it could be Unix, it could be whatever you want, and an input to this computer program machine, however you want to view it. And there are two options. Because these machines will either accept things or reject them, you have two options. If the machine halts with input W, then you want to accept it. You want to say, if this machine halts on this input, everything is cool, everything works out. And if M doesn't halt, then you want to say, this machine doesn't stop, it doesn't halt, it'll loop forever, and this is no good because we don't want to sit around forever waiting for something to finish. So let's assume this machine H exists, okay? We can make a small modification to this machine to do one thing different than this machine. So we have machine H prime, and rather than accept if it halts, let's put it into an infinitely looping state. So this is easy enough to do in a programming language. Most of you guys probably do it without even intending it. I do it sometimes too. Don't feel bad. So rather than accepting it, just have it loop. And this is really simple to do. You just say, go off to the right side of the tape and read in these blank spaces that fill up the tape. And as long as you get a blank space, keep going right. And it will continue reading memory forever. Or until you control C it or whatever. So this is a simple modification to this machine H. So if you give it a machine and an input to that machine, if the machine will halt, then it will loop. This machine here will loop forever. If the machine will not halt, then it will reject it. Well, now we can take another machine built on this machine and give it the same input. So let's make a machine called copy. All that copy does is it takes the input or whatever is on the tape when it starts and it puts it on the tape twice when it finishes. Very simple machine. It's pretty straightforward. No big deal. So if you give it a machine, in this case let's call it D, then the output of copy will be two of them. Okay? Now, let's take this output and let's give it to this H prime machine. So, let's put it over here. Right? So, if this machine, this arbitrary machine D, halts on input of the same machine, and yes, you can actually give a machine the input of itself. It might seem kind of hard to understand, but if you can take a machine and you can encode it into zeros or ones or whatever other alphabet you want, then you can put a machine into itself. It works. Trust me on it. So if the machine halts on input of itself, we'll have it loop. If it doesn't, then we'll have it reject it. Okay? So what's the problem with this? Well, if you take this as a box, this is also a Turing machine. And if you call this Turing machine D, you have something rather interesting here. You have a machine D that when you give it a copy of itself, if the machine halts, it'll loop forever. But if the machine doesn't halt, it'll halt. Can't do that. This is a contradiction, and this proves that there's no way to create another Turing machine that will tell if a given Turing machine will actually stop or not. And I'm sure there are questions at this point, so please feel free to ask away. Don't be shy.
I hope this doesn't apply to everything.
What do you mean by everything?
Just trying to deal with things. There's always this...
Anybody? There have been software products out there that supposedly will analyze your code and tell you whether your code will have an infinite loop or not. And these are garbage, because this proves that you can't do it. You can get it in a number of cases. You can try to find obvious pitfalls. But if you're looking at a machine as a program in C or a program in Perl or whatever your language of choice is, and somebody tries to say, well, we have this new solution that will find all the bugs in your program and prevent infinite loops or prevent anything undesirable from happening, it doesn't work. There's no way of telling whether this is going to stop or not. So, it might make the world kind of uncomfortable if you're a programmer, but unfortunately that's just the way it is.
Use while carefully.
Yeah. Yes?
Can you do the proof without the copy machine?
Well, the problem with just using H prime is that it takes two things for input. It takes the encoding of a machine and the input that would go to that machine. So the copy operation is just there so that you can feed the machine into itself by giving it only one input. If you wanted to get rid of the copy machine, you could just feed the representation of the machine in twice, but that's a less general case. The copy machine actually lets you do it for any input. Any other questions? Yes? Yes and no. I'm not touching things like quantum machines or anything like that. If you're looking at things that can be implemented in this sort of state machine, then yeah. A Turing machine will basically let you do whatever the hell you want. Yeah. Shh. Try not to confuse people. Any other questions?
Does P equal MP?
I personally think that's undecidable. I was actually going to ask that at the beginning of the talk to see what the audience's background was, but I forgot. So, I personally think it's undecidable. What do you think?
Well, even if it's undecidable, it's still either true or false.
If it's undecidable, it doesn't matter.
Well, that would mean we would never know
if
it's true or false, but it would still be true or false. Schrodinger's cat now.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's exactly right.
If you never know, then I don't think it really matters. Because if you could figure out how to use it to your advantage, you'd know. But that's my personal opinion. The more important question is, does B equal BPP? Okay. Never mind then. All right, we can talk about that if you want. Otherwise, any other questions? Or do people actually get what the hell I'm trying to talk about with this?
I'm just wondering how it applies to things. Things that computers that have a certain facet of this, and it sounds like it's hard, impossible to double check everything to make sure everything works in certain ways.
Well,
because the act of observing already gets in the way of being able to really observe it properly.
Well, it's not just about the halting thing. I think you came in later to the talk, right? Yeah. Basically, what I'm trying to explain is that things that people work with on a day-to-day basis in programming actually have a much more intricate and beautiful underlying pattern to them. In this case, I focused on regular expressions and the fact that a subclass of machines correspond directly to regular expressions. And that's how tools like grep work and finding things. Basically, I'm just trying to show that these conceptual machines that you can build if you really want to, whether in hardware or software, can actually do a whole lot more than people think they can, and that people have been relying too much on all of their software tools lately, like the fact that a stupid paperclip will tell you that you need to pound include IOStream rather than IOStream.h. Like, it's ridiculous these days. People don't know how to code anymore because they're relying too much on the language to hold their hand and to do their stuff for them. They don't understand that you can do things simply, efficiently, and this is why. This is proof that you can do it that way. And that's just sort of the point that I'm trying to extend to the audience. Yeah.
So how do you suggest the new up-and-coming programmers, or even getting the ones that are already out there, to understand these fundamentals?
Give them Apple IIs. Yeah, give them Apple IIs, or give them a book on computer science.
Take away Visual Basic.
This is the book that I've been working with for the material on this talk. Why? It's just the first book that I found on the subject. It's an introductory book to computer science. And I think the problem is that a lot of people who say they're computer people don't know any of the theory behind what they're doing. So they can still do it, but they're sort of groping blindly in the dark. And having an idea of the science behind what you're doing, like if you're a biologist, you want to know biology behind it before just saying, if I poke this animal with a stick, it falls over and dies. Funny that. Like, you want to know like what the hell you're doing before you start doing it. You can still figure out things if you have no clue, but you figure out things a lot more efficiently if you have an idea of the underlying principles behind what you're doing. So I would highly encourage anybody to look into actual computer science. Any other questions? Or the guy in the back is standing, so I think that's my cue that I'm done. Thank you very much for actually showing up. I didn't expect this large of an audience. If you have any questions, feel free to find me and bug me.